Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors and writers at strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, and your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin have just finished the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. Austin, recently there was an agreement made in Iraq for when the U.S. troops are going to pull out, and you wrote an article for us in your column that syndicated about it. Could you give us a little bit of the background of how that's come about and what the effect is going to be?
Well, Dan, you're talking about the column I wrote about the Status of Forces Agreement and the Security Framework Agreement that the United States government and the Iraqi government have been negotiating, really. I could argue that they've been discussing it since 2004, but formally making arrangements for a sovereign Iraq controlling its own territory, being responsible for its own security, and a future Iraqi-U.S. alliance. Now, those negotiations really started at the end of 2007. The SOFA governs U.S. forces operating in Iraq through the end of 2011. It's called in some places, I think, grossly inaccurately, withdrawal agreement. What it does is replace the UN Security Council resolution that the United States has been operating under in Iraq. And as it was pointed out by a senior Bush administration official, I got to listen in on one of those press conferences, the phone press conferences that White House arranged for a bunch of journalists. The fellow who was giving us the briefing pointed out that it is a conditions-based agreement, and that both parties, it takes both parties to renegotiate the SOFA, but it can be renegotiated. It only runs through, as I said, 2011. It does fit in with, as the spokesman said, current U.S. guidelines on pulling forces out of Iraqi urban areas by June, July 2009, and increasing Iraqi responsibility, particularly by the Iraqi army, for security operations within Iraq and along the Iraq's borders. That's the most controversial. That's the one that Muqtada al-Sadr's guys are arguing. And remember, they're really, in my view, front men for Iran, are arguing that it needs to be rejected by the Iraqi parliament. The other, the Security Framework Agreement, really is a more classic bilateral understanding between two fully sovereign countries, and it will help align economic, trade-oriented, cultural, and political, diplomatic arrangements between the United States and Iraq. And that, notice the SFA doesn't get any headlines at all. Now, in my own view, it's really remarkable to see the Iraqi parliament debating, because the parliament has to approve this their government's agreement, debating this in the open. Think back 5.5 years ago and imagine the kind of democratic, just try and imagine the kind of democratic operation that you're seeing in the Iraqi parliament going on in Saddam Hussein's Baghdad. It wouldn't have obtained. It wouldn't have exist. That in and of itself is a remarkable sign of Iraq's emerging democratic institutions and the fact that Iraq is really a new experience. It's a fragile experiment, but it's something new in the Arab-Muslim Middle East. And Maliki's government claims that they have the votes to get it through the parliament. The thing is, though, is it's got to have open debate, and they're having the open debate, and examine what the Iraqi parliament says we want to examine, what all the ins and outs are so that the United States can't take advantage of us. Well, that's going to be for the Iraqis themselves to decide. But like I said, SOFA runs for 3 years, and then after that, what the Iraqis will determine themselves what kind of local inside Iraq security arrangement they want with the United States. Now, let me point out a couple of things that I think are missed by mainstream media in looking at both the SFA and SOFA. First of all, they hadn't been imposed by the United States. The Iraqi government, you can look at all the Iraqis, and we cover this on Strategy Page all the time, saying, you know, we really don't want you to withdraw too fast. Maybe we don't want you to leave at all. And that talks about where there will be training cadres and remaining. I mean, the other instances is some of the technical support. Technical can be kind of a buzzword for air control. Now, the Iraqis have the agreements allow U.S., in fact, permit, ask for U.S. technical assistance. And the Iraqis have asked that in the realm of monitoring their own airspace. That is an indicator to me that the Iraqis are going to be relying on the U.S. Air Force for air cover. We covered on Strategy Page where the Iraqi Air Force is going, but they're not going to have fully capable fighter squadrons to patrol their own airspace, I think, for at least another decade. So there's going to be a relationship there, and the Iraqis are aware of it, and they want to be able to rely on the United States as an ally to supply air support and air cover. But the other things that I said that I haven't seen covered well, look at UN Security Council Resolution 1546, which was passed in early June of 2004. A draft of that was the first document, Dan, that I read that I had on my desk when I showed up in Baghdad in May of 2004. It is an open source international guideline for the process that was going to take Iraq from the Saddam Hussein era and the Iraq War onto full sovereignty and, as it says in there, a democratic government. It had lines, metrics that needed to be met, and it outlined to an election process. So I look at these SOFA and SFA agreements as being part of the process that's outlined in 1546. You see it in the January 2005 elections. That was part of what was outlined in 1546, and there was the Iraqi world witnessed that. The Iraqis with all their ink-stained fingers saying, we came out and voted. Now, I know that was mostly Shias. A lot of Sunnis live to regret that they didn't participate in that January 2005 election. They now are participating in the Iraqi politics. The other thing that plays a real role in this is the successful recreation of the Iraqi army, and I point to Operation Night's Charge, which again we covered in detail at Strategy Page, which kicked off in March and ran through April of this year, 2008. In some ways, that was the Iraqi army's coming out party to show you that not only can we plan, and they planned it, and then execute, and as the execution is included adaptation in the process of executing the operation, but also completed. And the Maliki government was adamant from the get-go that we did this one on our own. Our commanders ran it, and it was a mobile operation really involving especially the movement into Basra and throughout southern Iraq. I mean, I could see this, having planned division-sized mobile operations myself. It was multi-brigades, six, seven brigades, maneuvering in what is really tough to control terrain, urban terrain, complex urban terrain, and they had a dirty fight that went on for about a month. But it was not only ultimately successful on the ground, despite all their inefficiencies, they were better than the Shia gangs that they took on. They were better than the Mahdi army, and that's who they had to beat. But it worked at an extraordinary political level, because here you had a Shia leader, Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's prime minister, taking on Shia gangs, taking on groups that Iraqis know are frontmen for the mullahs in Tehran, and it was extremely politically popular with Iraqi Sunni Arabs and the Iraqi Kurds. Maliki used the Iraqi army's coming out party as a statement of saying, look, I'm a national leader. I'm a nationalist. I'm an Iraqi nationalist. I may be a Shia, but I'm an Iraqi leader, and take a look. We are now strong enough to go against these Shia separatists and Shia thugs. Again, the Mahdi army and Muqtada al-Sadr being the premier public example of that. That puts them in position to carry out these kind of what are politically difficult in some sectors in Iraq, negotiations with the United States to say, look, we need part of you here, but we don't want you occupying us. We're ready to stand on our own, but we're going to need allies. We're going to need reinforcements on occasions. We may need a rapid response force. We don't know what the future is going to hold, but take a look at what we've achieved over the last 4 or 5 years. We're ready. And those agreements, the spin here in the United States is generally, oh, it's bad, the United States is pulling out. No. Take a look at it. It's the other view is Iraq's ready for this. It's not a done deal. It's going to require vigilance. It's going to require adaptation. But these are part of a successful political process that you can see outlined in UN Security Council Resolution 1546.
And probably all of this is being overshadowed right now because of the economic news here in the U.S. and around the world, that this is news that would have been talked more about, hopefully, by the mainstream media if that hadn't been the case.
Well, that's a call. Here's before the economic troubles this summer, how much positive coverage, or I would say instead of positive, reasoned and honest coverage of events in Iraq did you see? Recall that Knight's Charge, with the exception of, I think, three national commentators, I'm one of them, Ralph Peters and also Jack Kelly. I recall reading Ralph Peters and Jack Kelly saying some things very similar to what I had to say about Knight's Charge when it kicked off. I was excited and I was impressed. Other commentators, Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was the Basra blunder. Maliki was a failure. The Iraqi army was a wreck. You know, the whole thing was a mistake. And you saw that kind of coverage, too, permeating national media. Until I recall a small headline in the New York Times, I think it wasn't on the front page, but it was a few pages back towards the end of April, where they said the Iraqi army had cleared out the last gang stronghold in Basra. Now, looked like a success. So, Dan, I think some of this is indicative of other issues in the coverage of Iraq that predates the economic decline.
Right.
Well, to cut the media some slack, they are as likely to cover debates in the American Congress over treaties as they are one in Iraq. They also cover anything that goes boom in Baghdad more than they'll cover any debates in the Iraqi parliament. Again, if it bleeds, it leads. And if it's just a bunch of politicians talking, you get no ink at all.
Right. I guess the thing
Knight's Charge bled, and look at the way that it was interpreted. Yeah, it bled, but it led as it was a failure. Anything but.
Yeah.
That's true, but they've been primed. They've sort of oriented themselves over years to expect nothing but failure, even if it isn't failure. And that is to the shame of the mainstream media. Something, of course, who's going to publicize to any great degree? It's something that, nice books will be written about, 10, 20 years from now. But right now we're just screwed. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, Dan, let me make one other point about that, though. I sat there and, look, I had the I feel lucky that I had the experience of that I had in the military, working in plans, and in operations shops in the G3 in the division. When Knight's Charge broke, and again, I was relying on wire service reports, some things from Pajamas Media had some of their bloggers from Iraq commenting on it. There were a bunch of things. There were things that we were getting through strategy page as well. I sat there and thought, wait a second. This is at least two divisions. Turned out it was probably a little more. The official number was 15,000, broken down into a couple of divisions. But the initial pulse, I was probably right. In other words, two understrength divisions, but well-trained by Iraqi standards. And I could say, okay, they have taken control of the roads. They're moving this group up. Why? They've launched a mobile operation in a very tough urban terrain against gangs and guerrilla groups that have had, in some cases, years to take control of the population, take control of the neighborhoods, and plot out what they would do if somebody came in here with armored personnel carriers and tanks. And it looks to me like they've got extremely good intelligence, so they wouldn't have launched it. That was my read on it at a distance. And you know what? Those military factors really were in play. It took you 5 weeks to get through it, which was one of the problems with the instantaneous naysayers. It took them 5 seconds because their minds were already made up in advance that it was a failure.
Right.
They didn't pay attention to what was going on in the battlefield.
Well, I think the biggest thing to point to, too, on the success is just look at the casualty rates. It looks like we're going to have the second month in a row where we're down below 20 casualties per month, which is, I think, a sign of great progress.
Oh, yeah. One Marine, the last month, one Marine battalion in Afghanistan. Over the last 6 months, one Marine battalion in Afghanistan has had more casualties than all 20,000 Marines, in Iraq.
Right. Yeah. So that's not getting reported either. What's happening in Afghanistan is, of course, their operations are coming to a close right now because it's getting so darn cold there.
Actually, they're going to keep going through the winter.
Oh, so they're going to keep the pace up then.
Yeah, because the Afghans normally stay inside in the wintertime, and they're not going to give them. The Pakistanis are doing the same thing. So, again, another underreported story, except in strategy page, is that the Taliban are getting hammered to death. You know, all you hear about is, Afghanistan is unsafe and yada, yada. But, you know, if you look at the big picture, as it were, like we do, it's quite different. But, you know, that isn't the kind of news the mainstream news wants to cover. That's just the way it goes.
Well, Jim, let's move on to talking about the F-22. It seems like we almost have an article on the F-22 every week this year. There's controversy around it. There's different things happening with it. Are we going to get down to where we have one F-22 and two pilots?
What's going on with the F-22, the reason we're covering it so much is because things are happening in Washington and with the Air Force, and that is the result of a ongoing battle between the head of the people running the Defense Department and the Air Force itself. The Air Force wants more F-22s, and they've gotten Congress, the congressional allies, to come up with the money. But the president and the secretary of defense basically don't want more F-22s. We haven't actually covered that particular story directly. You know, we mentioned it in passing, but it is apparently the battle. The latest one, which we reported, was the Air Force, as we reported it, the Air Force wants to spend $83 million per aircraft on 100 of the F-22s they already have to upgrade them. Now, I looked at the reports, you know, press releases and what have you about that, and I said, this can't be right. I went back and double-checked. And, of course, we ran that bit, you know, what, last week or several days ago. And now there are stories coming out, the Air Force is crying foul. Now, I haven't gone in there and dissected everything that, you know, their Air Force is talking about. Why is it a foul? I mean, are you not spending all that money on these already expensive aircraft? I mean, $83 million, you could buy an F-35 for that and have some spare change left over. So it's hard to tell, exactly who's going to win this battle. Because what it comes down to is, how many F-22s do we need?
Right.
There's no agreement.
Right, and we're not sure of that, especially with the cheaper F-35 coming on board, right?
Yes, and the F-35 is a fairly formidable air-to-air, you know, combat aircraft. We did run a piece recently on Norway buying them instead of the much cheaper Gripen from neighboring Sweden. And the reason the Norwegians went with the more expensive F-35 was because one of their defense institutes ran some computer simulations and came up with the surprising conclusion that the Gripen would not be able to handle itself against the top Russian fighters if it ever came to an incident, you know, on their common border in way in the north. But the F-35, which was being offered to them, could handle, you know, the top Russian fighters. And this is what a lot of people in the American Department of Defense are talking about. They say, look, we're buying over a thousand of these F-35s. So why do we need, you know, an aircraft that's four times as expensive, the F-22? But the Air Force, let me put it this way. The Air Force is the victim of its own success. The U.S. Air Force has dominated any airspace it's fought over for the last 70 years. I mean, that's unprecedented. You know, the British talk about, you know, ruling the seas for, you know, two centuries. Well, for most of the time that there have been aircraft, American aircraft have been in charge.
Right.
I mean, that's something, you know, nobody pays much attention to. I mean, you just take it for granted. You know, the U.S. Air Force rules the skies. But it bites you in the rear end when you ask for the kind of aircraft that you believe you need to keep that going. It is a difficult argument to make because people are saying, you know, it's the price of success. Hey, you're doing so well. What do you need more for?
Right.
But, you know, the Air Force may ultimately be right. I mean, it's not a clear-cut argument. The Air Force is talking about, you know, China, who is a potential ally, at least for an air battle, building up, you know, a force of hundreds of modern, you know, SU-30, which are basically, you know, clumsy F-15s, I can best describe them as. But they're a formidable aircraft. Although recently we covered a training exercise using Indian SU-30s, which are top end, you know, they're SU-30s with a lot of Western avionics in them, fighting against American F-15s, F-16s, and F-22s. They didn't do all that well. I mean, the pilots were good, the aircraft performed fairly well, but they were not a super, you know, opponent. You know, the Air Force, U.S. Air Force didn't go away feeling, oh my God, we're in trouble. They said, we can handle that. So unless the Chinese are going to come up with something really surprising, which is a possibility, all this cyber espionage, all these electronic break-ins into military, you know, defense company, you know, databases and stealing information, this could be a big problem in a future air war. Obviously, you know, it involves, you know, being able to short circuit the other guy's electronic defenses or, you know, electronics in general, by knowing exactly how they work and zapping them, you know, in just the right way. It won't necessarily make the Chinese invincible, but it can make us a lot less invincible. But what it all comes down to is, you know, how much air superiority do you need in order to remain, keep control of the air? And right now the Air Force is losing that argument, and it's going to get ugly because the Air Force does what all the other services have been doing, you know, since World War II, is they go and get lobbyists and get congressional allies, I mean, there's a lot of money in building F-22s, and congressmen perk up, you know, when you talk about putting a plant in their district that has $100 million a year payroll.
Right.
Votes.
Now, the Russians decided to go a different route than developing a whole new airframe. They have taken the SU-27, which was an 80s aircraft.
The F-15 clone, yeah.
Right, and they've continued to upgrade it until now. They've got the SU-37, which they consider a 4.5 generation aircraft, and they're seeing what they can push out of that airframe rather than coming up with a brand new airframe. And then I think you reported also recently on the T-50, which is that not also based on the same airframe?
Apparently there is no new airframe. And in many respects, that's a good way to go. I mean, the Russians were very successful for that in wartime during World War II. They stuck with it after World War II, which nobody else really did. The French did it to a certain extent. We do it to a certain extent, but not as much as the Russians. The only exception is the F-18.
Right.
The F-18E, which is looks like, at a distance, like the original F-18, is actually an enormous rebuild of the basic F-18 design. But in Russian terms, it makes sense to them. That's what they would do. They would take the F-18. That's what they did with the SU-27. The F-18E is basically the SU-37, to the SU, the original SU-27. And it's actually a cheaper way to go, especially the way modern combat aircraft are built. More and more, it's not so much the airframe, but it's the engines, which can be replaced and often are with more powerful ones, and the electronics, in particular the electronics, and of course better missiles. This is why the Indians pointed out during the recent, red flag exercises between their SU-30s and our fighters, was that they have a souped-up MiG-21, which has Western electronics in it and can carry long-range radar-guided missiles. And their point was, and our guys took it to heart, he says, this aircraft compared to, the behemoths that were flying, the F-15 and the SU-30 are basically large aircraft. He says, the thing is tiny. It's hard to, not only is it hard to pick up visually, but it's hard to pick up on radar because it's so small. And it's equipped as well as just about any, modern fighter aircraft with a good radar, good countermeasures, and a good, radar-guided air-to-air and heat-seeking missiles. And he says, this could be a formidable opponent even for a F-22. And many air forces have been going in this direction because they basically did the math and realized, geez, we can take this old airframe and just put all these new modern electronics and missiles on it, and we've got a pretty formidable aircraft. It can spot the other guy a long distance off. It can fire a very effective missile on him. Why put all this stuff into a much more expensive aircraft that isn't necessary? It's similar to what's happening with the smart bombs. People like to joke, half-jokingly, that, hey, you could basically buy a 757 and rig it to drop smart bombs. It'd be a lot cheaper.
Right, and that's why the B-52 is going to continue to fly
forever. Yeah, the cheapest way to deliver smart bombs is the B-52.
Yeah.
Because it's still cheap to operate.
Yep. Well, coming full circle to the F-22 again, what do you think is going to actually happen? Are we going to, I think what, the numbers right now that they've been allocated?
183 is what they're authorized.
Uh-huh.
They want to get over 250. They might get a few extra. I mean, it comes down to Congress. It's politics, as we keep pointing out on the strategy page.
Right.
And what this aircraft is most useful for is the opening attacks, going in there and basically going through heavy enemy air defenses, radars, missiles, and what have you, because it is stealthy, it is fast, it is capable, and taking out the enemy air defenses, even hitting enemy air bases. But after that, an F-15 or F-16 will do the job.
Right.
The question is, how many F-22s do you need for that initial attack against two? I mean, there aren't that many enemies we have left.
No.
The Chinese have more, are buying so many modern Russian aircraft. Pretty soon they're going to have more. They might even have as many or more in service than the Russians do, because although the Russians have a lot of those SU-27s and SU-30s, they haven't got the money to, you know, keep them in service. So the most formidable Russian air force in the world today is China. And it's a basically a crapshoot whether or not we might ever be engaged with them, and even then it would be over the, you know, the Taiwan Straits. We're not talking about World War III here. Nobody else. I mean, Iran has got nothing. They got a couple of MiG-29s, nothing. North Korea, nothing. You know, a couple of MiG-29s, and they're basically targets in the couple of times we've gone up against them. So who are you going to fight with whatever amount of F-22s have you got? And
right.
When the Air Force gets asked that question, they sort of, you know, get tongue-tied.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to watch the whole thing, and everybody knows where they can come to get the best information on it. It's right here at Strategy Page. So thank you very much, Jim, and
all right.
We'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.